So today I have the honor of introducing our luncheon speaker, Mr. Michael Medved. Michael Medved is a nationally syndicated radio talk show host, best-selling author, and veteran film critic. His daily three-hour broadcast reaches close to 4 million listeners and now over 300 stations across the country. He is author of a dozen nonfiction books, including his New York Times extended bestseller, The 10 Big Lies About America, Combating Destructive Distortions About Our Nation, and his most recent New York Times bestseller is The American Miracle, Divine Providence in the Rise of the Republic. Please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Thank you so very much, Deanna, and thank you, President McNulty. I'm speaking today about a riddle, which I want to try to answer. And the riddle is, how could it possibly be that in a world in which, rightly, Nazism is completely held in contempt and utterly unacceptable, you will find people who still try to defend, excuse, even romanticize the comparable barbarism of world communism, even Stalinism. And there was a prominent example of that yesterday. It came up, we covered it on the show. In Great Britain, Prime Minister May, she should live and be well and succeed, and has called a new election, a snap election for June 8th. And one of the candidates of her Tory party, of her Conservative party, is a British Olympian, gold medal winner. He won 2 gold medals in rowing, which I guess if you're British, you take any gold medals you can get at the Olympics, because, you know, the United Kingdom has not been a great Olympic power. So his name is James Cracknell. And James Cracknell was doing an interview 2 days ago with Sky News. And again, he is a candidate for Parliament. And his main issue in running for Parliament is obesity. And obesity is a problem in the United Kingdom, as it is in the United States, it is in much of the Western world. And in his colloquy with Sky News, would-be MP Cracknell said, you know, there are only 2 nations that have a handle on obesity. Do you know what they are? And the Sky News reporter said, no, I wouldn't have a clue. He said, well, the only 2 nations that have a handle on obesity are North Korea and Cuba. Now, there's so much wrong with that statement. I mean, first of all, and most obviously, the leader of North Korea does not appear to have licked the obesity problem. I'm sorry. You know, take a look at some of the television appearances, like today when he has just issued this statement that he is preparing a super mighty preemptive strike against the United States that will reduce the United States to ashes. He looks pretty prosperous himself, but the rest of his country is starved to death. There are at least 3 million people who have been starved to death by government policies in North Korea. Starvation is not an acceptable answer to obesity. Can we understand that? And what North Korea and Cuba have in common is they are the 2 Stalinist survivors of the absolute worst of communism, and that someone would be so ignorant, so pathetic, and even a member of the Conservative Party in Britain, that in 2017 he would cite North Korea and Cuba as examples of anything other than examples of the devastating costs of communist dictatorship. That's appalling. But there's another example that came up on the show yesterday, and a question that was posed that I want to answer with my remarks to you this morning. And I was on with Paul Kangor, and our last caller was a guy named Jim from Honolulu. And one of the great things about talk radio is you get callers from all over the country, and you kind of get to know some of them. They become figures in your imagination, even though you never see them. Now, Jim in Honolulu had never called before, because I would remember. He called with a singularly pathetic point. I was, as was Paul, we were talking about Paul's new book, which is wonderful, the book A Pope and a President, and or it may be A President and a Pope. Do you give prime of place to church or state? Either way, it's of course about Pope John Paul II and President Reagan, and I'm sure we're going to hear about that later in this conference. In any event, so he was saying, you and Professor Kenger are talking so harshly about communism, and but you don't mention the fact that capitalism has killed even more people. Capitalism's even more oppressive, even more dangerous, even more genocidal. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, capitalism killed at least 150 million people because of the crime of slavery, which was the very essence of capitalism. So how do you respond to that kind of stupidity? That's what I want to get at, okay? And again, and to get at it, I hope, in a more meaningful way than one can do in a radio show where there are strictures of time because you're fenced in by the true priorities of radio, which have to do with commercials. And that's capitalism. But that doesn't kill 150 million people. Not any of my sponsors in any event. All right. Let me address this problem very directly, that is the title of these remarks, which is the contrast between the way people respond to Nazism and the contrast to the way they respond to communism, where actually both isms, both monstrous and barbaric forms of tyranny, should rest forever on the ash heap of history. Why do people still look at communism more favorably? And again, there is in recent news a proof of that. They just had an election. I'm not talking about the election in the 6th Congressional District of Georgia. I'm talking about the exciting election in Ecuador. And if you blinked, you may have missed it. But in Ecuador, Ecuador has been under the domination of one of these few surviving leftist would-be dictators in the world, President Correa. And President Correa's handpicked successor, who won a very shady election, and he won allegedly by less than a percentage point. And when you have a leftist strongman and a handpicked successor, but the handpicked successor is a 67-year-old gentleman whose name is Lenin Moreno, okay? Now, Lenin is not a name that he took, but it is a name that he glories in. He is referred to by his acolytes as Lenin, and so they're out there in Ecuador chanting, Viva Lenin! He is the president-elect of Ecuador. He's about to take office because he won this narrowly contested election. And I actually went to some trouble to research this. How does someone who was born in 1953 as Lenin Moreno, so I just miscalculated his age. Let's give him his full due. He was born in 53, so he's 64. Okay. How does someone born in 53, which is the same year that Stalin died, right? How does someone like that get a name Lenin? And it turns out his father was an academic who idolized Vladimir Ilyich, the original Lenin. Now, contrast this with what would happen if someone named their child Adolf Hitler Jones. You don't even have to ask. There was a case in New Jersey, we covered it on the air 3 years ago, where someone went into a supermarket and asked for a birthday cake, and they asked in New Jersey for the birthday cake. They said, I want to say on the cake, happy birthday, Adolf Hitler. And the person who was taking the order said, I don't think I want to make that cake. He said, no, don't worry, it's for my child, whose name is Adolf Hitler, and it was Smith. So here's the story. And again, I followed this up because it's fascinating. They called Child Protective Services. right, as they should. And he had a child named Hermann Göring something. He had a, you know, Child Protective Services took the kids away. He had given some of his older kids swastika tattoos. This was clearly not a fit parent. And he was a drunk Nazi. And, okay, so meanwhile, someone names their kid Hitler, and the child is taken away, appropriately, it seems to me, by Child Protective Services in New Jersey. And yet, in Ecuador, a child is named Lenin, and he gets elected president. What is the deal? Now, people who want to say that communism is different from Nazism will justify drawing that distinction on three bases. One of them is fairly valid and comprehensible. The other two are nonsensical and very important to address. The one that's comprehensible is, look, the greatest war in human history, the Nazis lost, and the commies arguably won. And this is something that those of us who hate and despise communism have to look at the fact of the war and the truth of the war. Both Churchill and Roosevelt understood, and rightly so, that Stalin became, butcher that he was, indispensable in defeating the Russians. The one thing that is so stupid and drives me crazy, Oliver Stone did a recent book about the recent history, his revision of the history of the 20th century, and he said America claims credit for winning World War II, and it wasn't America who won World War II, it was Russia entirely. They were a little bit tardy in getting involved against the Japanese, though they kept promising that they would. We had to handle that pretty much on our own. But the second point is it was American capitalism that won that war. And the idea that the communists and their propagandists and apologists claim credit for their victory in the war, first of all, there were at least 25 million Russians who died in the war. There are 430,000 Americans. But the number of deaths and the devastation in Russia and the result of the war for the Russians was the occupation and suppression of well over 150 million people in Eastern Europe, in Poland and the Czech Republic and Hungary and throughout Eastern Europe, the Iron Curtain that Churchill talked about. So to say that, well, communism should not be condemned for Nazism because they had a good war. They had a good war only because American capitalism won that war by producing the airplanes and the ships and the landing craft and the materiel that were able to win the war. That's the untold history of World War II. And it's extraordinarily important that people remember it. That it was American industrialists who turned their full energy and the full productive energy of this great arsenal of democracy into producing the weapons that we sent to Archangel and gave to Stalin that allowed him to help kill a lot of Nazis. Okay, so the first point that people bring up is, well, didn't communism win the war? The Nazis lost the war. Yeah, but winning the war for the communists produced the same kind of brutal results that the early victories for the Wehrmacht produced for the people under occupation. Mass slaughter, tyranny. And yet that tyranny of the communist suppression of all of the captive nations of Eastern Europe lasted far longer than the Nazi occupations. The second point that people bring up is that the Nazism is far more evil than communism because it has a racial component. Because the communists don't believe in the Herrenvolk, the master race. In fact, one of the ideals of communism is people of all nations. And by the way, I'm sorry to laugh, but one of the things that a guilty pleasure is I enjoy looking at North Korean propaganda, and one of the things that they show the current leader commonly with enlightened beloved leader Kim Jong-un with children of many nations. And they show all these nations and it's not just Koreans, of course. People all over the world admire him, because you may not know this, he is one of the most brilliant writers ever in all of human history, and acclaimed as such by the North Korean press. He writes plays and poems, and it's extraordinary because he's only about 14 years old. Actually, I think he's 30 now, but. In any event, the point about all of this, children of many nations, this notion that the Nazis uniquely singled out people based upon who they were, their ancestry, for suppression and for murder. And this is something that communism, for all of its victims, did not do. And the question that I would put to you is that, what do you call the Holomor, the forced Ukrainian hunger famine of 1932, 33, and 34, where Stalin deliberately starved to death between 3 million and 7 million Ukrainians? And partially it was ethnic, because Stalin, who was not a Russian, he was a Georgian, wanted to maintain the hold of Russia over Ukrainians. But what it was specifically was, it was a war against the kulaks, a war against the peasants who owned their own land and were resistant to communism. Now, I would submit that mass murder based upon economic status is every bit as evil as mass murder based upon race or religious identity. And the idea that we distinguish mass murder of one kind and say this is somehow more acceptable. It's more acceptable to kill rich people. It's more acceptable to kill middle-class people. It's more acceptable to kill parents and children, one another. What I bring up here, and this is a little bit of an aside, but it is one of those things that convinced me that communism is every bit as evil as Nazism, that they are comparable. And to say that one is more evil than another is a dangerous fallacy. It's the tale of Pavlik Morozov. Do people know the story of Pavlik Morozov? Yes, some of you do. Pavlik Morozov was a hero to Komsomol. Komsomol was the old commie Boy Scouts. It was the young pioneers. And in the bad old days of the Soviet Union, every young man and young girl had to go ahead and become a young pioneer. You had to be in Komsomol, where they would indoctrinate you into the party. And the hero of Komsomol, the number one hero, was Pavlik Morozov. Pavlik Morozov was a Ukrainian peasant boy who informed on his parents because they were holding grain. And he pledged his leadership to Comrade Stalin, father of peoples, and participated willingly in the execution of his own parents, who were both killed. Pavlik subsequently, and they don't really celebrate this in Komsomol, Pavlik was then strangled to death by his grandfather because he had betrayed his parents. And the whole thing is just one of these horrible stories. But it was a part of the ideology of the evil empire. Children meant be like Pavlik. You give your first loyalty to the state. You worship G government, not G God. Because we know what the communist attitude was toward God. So the idea that mass murder is less evil, less nightmarish when it is practiced on people based on economic status or based on ideology rather than based upon religion or ethnicity, I think is a very, very dubious proposition. But the most dubious proposition of all is the one that is most common in terms of apologists for communist barbarity, both in our current day world and in the world of the past. And when I talk about our current day world, we've talked about this idiot Cracknell, who thinks that North Korea and Cuba have such an exemplary handle on obesity. And we've talked about Lenin Moreno. Can we talk for a moment about a director who is a wonderful artist in terms of his films, Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg, who I know a little bit, I think has created some of the greatest films ever made. I think Saving Private Ryan counts. I think that Schindler's List counts. And Steven Spielberg has devoted a great deal of his life to studying and memorializing the Holocaust, and I give him credit for that. But he went down recently to meet Fidel Castro. And it obviously isn't too recent, because it's kind of tough to meet Castro now unless you go to hell. And which is, I'm quite certain where he will be found and available for interviews. And in any event, Spielberg came back from his long extended dinner with Castro, and the dinner ended up lasting 5 hours because Fidel liked to talk. And he said, the 5 hours I spent with Fidel, because he's always Fidel, always have one name, the 5 hours I spent with Fidel were the most important 5 hours of my life. Now, not the hours where he met his wife, Kate Capshaw, not the hours of where any of his 7 children were born, not the hours that he used creating his movie masterpieces, and he has the 5 hours with Fidel Castro. Steven, how can you say that? How can you say that? You know about the evils of the Holocaust. What about the evils of the genocidal regime in Cuba that Castro instituted and defended and exemplified? And the answer would always be, and the answer comes true, there was a book that was published in 1997 called The Romance of American Communism. The Romance of American Communism. Vivian Gornick wrote the book. It was a series of interviews of old commies in the United States. And the point that she made in the book is, well, communism didn't work out that well in the Soviet Union. Collapsed, the dream died, as she put it, but it was a beautiful dream. It was not a beautiful dream. It was never a beautiful dream. And this is the point that is most important to impress upon students, is people who dream of controlling other human beings through governmental force are engaged not in a beautiful dream, they're engaged in an evil dream. It is evil, it is wrong to believe that your version of reality should give you the power to dominate, to oppress, and to murder other people at will. It is utterly unacceptable. And the notion that these American communists, they didn't know what was going on in the Gulag. They didn't know about Stalin's mass murders. Paul Kengor has written beautifully about how none of that is true. None of that is true. People knew, but they justified it because the beautiful dream they have of enforced equality is not a beautiful dream. And this brings me to the comment that I mentioned from Jim in Honolulu. Jim in Honolulu, who believes that capitalism has killed far more people than communism has, 150 million, he says. And as Paul pointed out on the air, that's odd because actually 150 million is the revised estimate, revised upward, of the victims of world communism. 150 million human beings. And that's not people who died in war. That's people who are murdered, victims of murder. The basic point over here is what a terrible mistake to excuse evil because someone meant well. I can very well assure you that Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo, you say in Hebrew, may his name be blotted out, that Adolf Hitler did not wake up in the morning and twirl his mustache and think, how much evil can I do today? He woke up every morning thinking, what can I do to ensure this tausend Jahre Reich, this 1,000-year rule that he is going to make for a glorious Germany? The most evil people in the world claim to be motivated by good intentions, and in their own minds they are. But you need a guide, and an abiding guide, to divide between good and evil. And that brings up the most important point in response to Jim in Honolulu, the need for a moral defense of capitalism. And that moral defense ought to be easy for those people, both religious and secular, who believe in the fundamentals of Western morality, which are stated in the New Testament, as do unto others as you would have them do unto you, the golden rule, and stated in the Old Testament and the New Testament as v'yahavta v'reacha kamocha in Hebrew, love your neighbor as you love yourself. You treat other people as you would yourself. And this is why slavery was never an expression of capitalism. Slavery, unfortunately, is an expression of the same kind of tyranny and barbarism that Stalin exemplified and that Hitler exemplified and that Pharaoh exemplified in the biblical story, and that has been exemplified by all tyrants in world history. What slavery believes is that you have the right, either because of birth or destiny or just because you can grab it, of seizing the labor of someone else. It is theft. And that is the essence of what communism is. Except instead of imposing the evils of slavery based upon race, you're going to enslave everyone to an all-powerful government. Ayn Rand makes the distinction that to get other people to do what you want, which is the basic question for any governmental organization, for any economic organization, for getting anything done in the world, how do you get other people to do what you want them to do? There are two ways, either persuasion or force. What communism and Nazism and slavery are based upon is force, not persuasion. What is persuasion? The essence of persuasion is money. That's what it is. It's the way you get somebody else to do what you want that person to do. And basically, in that sense, capitalism is the only antidote to slavery. Not an example of it. Which is why the leading business people and the leading defenders and advocates of business, including Abraham Lincoln, who was a great believer in the free market and a great believer in the capitalist system, understood that nothing undermined that system more than slavery, which gave no right to the individual to keep the fruits of his own labor. And this brings us to contemporary politics. Because one of the most important lessons to take away from this brief discussion about communism versus Nazism and why they are minor differences, differences of focus, not differences of essence in those two evil systems, why that is so relevant to today's political debates. The point about today's political debates you need to take away from here is do not judge candidates, do not judge political parties, do not judge propositions based upon, oh, they were so very well intentioned. And do not run into the idea, which unfortunately too many conservatives do, that the fact that people do stupid, horrible, destructive things means that they are ill-intentioned. Most of the terrible things in the world happen because of good intentions. It doesn't make them less terrible. It doesn't take away from the nature of the deed. Evil is evil based upon the way it shows the disrespect for other human beings who are created in the image of God. And good is good in the sense that it shows and exemplifies that respect for your fellow beings who are created in the image of God. There's a book that came out right near the turn of the century called The Black Book of Communism. It became an international bestseller. And it's worth remembering the essence of what it teaches. It was written by a French scholar, and by the way, he's a scholar who came to this from the left. And he wanted to research the death toll from all of communist slaughter in the 20th century. Of course, some of that slaughter has continued in places like North Korea and Cuba into the 21st century. But he came up with a figure of 100 million human beings. And toward the end of his book, Stéphane Courtois wrote this: after 1945, the Jewish genocide by the Nazis became a byword for modern barbarism, the epitome of 20th century mass terror. More recently, a single-minded focus on the Jewish genocide in an attempt to characterize the Holocaust as a unique atrocity has also prevented the assessment of other episodes of comparable magnitude in the communist world. After all, it seems scarcely plausible that victors who had helped bring about the destruction of a genocidal apparatus might themselves have put the very same methods into practice. When faced with this paradox, people generally preferred to bury their heads in sand. Communist regimes have victimized at least 100 million people, in contrast to the approximately 25 million of the Nazis. It's worth remembering. And worth remembering, finally, the theme of my new book. My new book is called The American Miracle: Divine Providence in the Rise of the Republic. For people who doubt that America is uniquely blessed, that America is a creation not of a few extraordinarily enlightened founders, but as a creation of something higher. You know where to go for proof? Well, where you go, of course, is you immediately get a copy of The American Miracle, which was just published, and which I will be very glad to sign for you while I'm doing my broadcast from 3 to 6 in the lobby here. But aside from that, go to the founders themselves. Because even the founders themselves, who were religiously unconventional, people like Jefferson and Franklin, who were not conventional Christians, never doubted that they were the instruments of a divine plan and not its authors. They saw it clearly. And by the same token, to say that America has been chosen by God for special purpose in this world doesn't mean we have special privileges, doesn't even mean we deserve it. The song says, America, America, God shed his grace on thee. The notion of grace is it's undeserved. You don't earn it. It's given to you. God has chosen this country not because of our unique goodness, but in order to perform unique goodness. It grants us not special privilege, it grants us special responsibility. My thanks to all of you in playing a role in fulfilling that responsibility. My thanks to this wonderful college for the remarkable role that it continues to play. And may we all continue to bless our own work, to bless America's work in saving the world, and to continue to honor, protect, and nourish this greatest nation on God's green earth. Thank you very, very much for your attention. Can I, Lee, take a few questions? Yes, questions, comments. Anyone who wants to defend communism, you wouldn't be at this conference. No, of course it does. And by the way, this is one of the anomalies that I've written about on many occasions. The Holocaust and the excesses of, I should say excesses, the unspeakable evil of the Nazis has been covered in a series of remarkable films. Schindler's List, I think, is still probably the best of them, but there was a new film called The Zookeeper's Wife that came out that was quite good, about a Polish couple who heroically rescued people at the height of Nazi barbarism in Warsaw, starring Jessica Chastain. It's a movie worth seeing if you can still see it. But it's virtually impossible to think of films that show the horrors of communism. And really, it's one of the great stories of the 20th century. It is. It's inescapable. And it's in people's family history. I have relatives from Ukraine. My grandfather came from Ukraine in 1910, thank God. But I have relatives that we know about who were murdered by the communists, and relatives who were murdered by the Nazis. And to a surprising extent, they worked together in their brutal affair. But again, to try to think, they made a movie recently about the hunger famine in Ukraine, which was funded by a number of Ukrainian oligarchs, and it was terrible. It was really an extremely disappointing film. But that is a great subject. And the end of the Soviet Union and the miraculous tearing down of the Berlin Wall, there was a little bit of that in Spielberg's movie Bridge of Spies. But it's almost unknown. So you're completely correct. The communist propaganda machine continues. Yes, Spiros. Yes, and gay ex-communist. He's part of one of these clear-sighted gay ex-communists. Now, that's a small group, but go ahead. No, extraordinary. And by the way, and this is for the president-elect of Ecuador, the idea that this was a beautiful dream that Lenin and Trotsky dreamed, and then this evil Stalin came and he messed it all up, is nonsense. By the way, it is similar to people will say the same thing about Napoleon, right? That the French revolutionaries were so idealistic and pure and democratic and wonderful, and then the mean Napoleon came and he corrupted the whole thing. Nonsense! The French revolutionaries were barbarous. They murdered nuns. They desecrated churches. They executed at least 25,000 civilians for no reason, because they were bloody, horrible people. And again, one of the things that you raise, and it's enormously important, is that no, it was not that communism was a beautiful dream and then Stalin died in 1953 and then all of a sudden the evil stain went away. The evil stain began with Marx, and of course it very much continued with Lenin. And we shouldn't be naming people after Lenin. Sane people would not do that any more than people would name their children after Hitler. And apparently there are some Americans who do that. One of the things I was going to bring to your attention also is, do you remember Carlos the Jackal? Okay. Yes! His real name was Ilyich. He was named, his father had named, he had three children, three sons. One was named Vladimir, the other was named Ilyich, who's Carlos the Jackal, and the other was named Lenin. Okay, this is Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. I mean, unbelievable. That, you alert Child Protective Services. You know, I'd love to try to enforce that. If people name a child Fidel Castro something, or Vladimir Ilyich something, yes, let Child Protective Services know. Yes, second to last question, then penultimate question, and then the ultimate question. Yes, and it's a good question, but that it is a subset of the much larger difference, which is the communists were seen as victors in the war, and they did win the war. I mean, let's face it, they killed more Nazis than anyone else, and a lot of it in incredibly bloodthirsty ways. And so victors tend to be able to control the narrative. And to that extent, yes, you're right. The communists were very much participants in revealing some of Hitler's horrors. And had Hitler won the war? Hitler was the original Holocaust denier. And had Hitler won the war, and there's a very interesting novel about this called Fatherland, which is a sort of an alternate history of what would have happened if Hitler had won the war. And part of what would have happened is he would have continued to try to conceal the true genocidal extent and purposes of the Holocaust. To say that, well, there are some people who died of starvation and this, but that the idea that we were actually murdering people, yes, Sean Spicer, with poison gas, the idea that actually happened would have been concealed. Last question. Yes, sir. Well, again, I think that part of that has to do with heritage and tradition, but they would take, and you know that the way they apologize and encourage it is, for instance, it was interesting, I looked up the critical response to the Black Book of Communism, which I just mentioned, by Stéphane Courtois. It's edited by Stéphane Courtois, where he compiles the proof that 100 million people were murdered by communism in the 20th century alone. And the critical response to that book says he's way wrong, there's no historical basis for this. At most, there were 93 million people who were killed, not 100 million, and at least 65 million were killed. And I'm sorry, even if it is just 65 million, and it's not, it's probably over 100 million. So to that extent, they still try to excuse it. What they will say is that very, very few people will say that, there are people in Russia now who think Stalin was a good man, and they celebrate his birthday again. And even Putin has said some things that have been exculpatory for Stalin. People will say that, look, during the war, there were terrible things that were done, and Stalin was a deeply disturbed individual, but the fact that he took things to excess does not mitigate the beautiful equality and the economic progress that Russia made, or that Cuba made, or that, and all of this, of course, is nonsense. Is the reality of standards of living, even in those terms of communism, are completely unsupportable. But all of this comes to a violation of what is the least favorite of the Ten Commandments by the left. The least favorite of the Ten Commandments is not thou shalt not kill, even though the left has done unspeakable amounts of killing. It's also not thou shalt not steal, though theft is the very essence of the leftist project, as taking stuff that you didn't create and didn't earn. the least favorite of the Ten Commandments? Number 10, don't covet. And by the way, it's the only one of the Ten Commandments that commands you about a feeling. Don't covet. Not action, feeling. What's the problem with coveting? The problem with coveting is thinking that there is a limited supply of goodness in the world. And it comes from a secular worldview. And that's the answer to your question. Secularism is stubbornly defended as if life depended on it, and it does, life in this world and in the afterlife. Secularism is stubbornly defended by academia. And the very core belief of secularism is the denial of an infinite creator God. If you believe in an infinite creator God, you don't have to worry about how are we going to cut up the pie. Because you know that human beings created in God's image are infinitely creative. We can create more. If you're a secularist, you believe that when the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. In other words, that creating wealth causes poverty. And if you believe that, you're an idiot. The point is that answering these extremes of secularism are going to be crucial to exposing the extremes and making these, once again, as you point out, the hallowed halls of truth. Wonderful to be in these hallowed halls. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Michael. You're always fantastic. We appreciate you coming all the way out here from Seattle.